Good afternoon. I'm Brett Kavanaugh of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Welcome to today's panel, sponsored by the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group of the Federalist Society. Our panelists today will address the controversial and important topic of shareholder access to proxy materials. And we have four excellent and distinguished panelists to discuss and debate the issues. What I'll do is I'll introduce all four of them. They'll each speak for a few minutes, and then they'll each comment on the others' remarks. And after that, we'll look forward to taking questions from the audience. E. Norman Vesey is a senior partner at Weil, Gotshal & Manges. He serves as a strategic advisor to the firm's clients on a wide range of issues related to mergers and acquisitions. He advises on corporate governance issues involving the responsibilities of corporate directors in complex financial transactions and crisis management. He's the former Chief Justice of Delaware, having stepped down from the Delaware Supreme Court in 2004 after serving with great distinction for 12 years as the top judicial officer of that state's judicial branch. Stephen Bainbridge is the William D. Warren Professor of Law at UCLA, where he has taught, among other things, business associations, corporation law, corporate finance, securities regulation, mergers and acquisitions. He is a prolific scholar whose work has a strong emphasis on the law and economics of public corporations. He's written over 75 law review articles, and his blog, ProfessorBainbridge.com, is one of the most widely read political and legal blogs on the Internet. Damon Silvers, who will be here shortly, is an associate general counsel for the AFL-CIO. His responsibilities include bankruptcy, corporate governance, and pension and general business law issues for the AFL-CIO. He's a member of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board's Standing Advisory Group and the Financial Accounting Standards Board User Advisory Council. And John Olson is a founding partner of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher's Washington, D.C. office. He has extensive experience in general representation of business organizations as to corporate governance, corporate securities, finance, and merger and acquisition matters. He's counseled many boards of directors and board committees on governance issues and in assessing shareholder litigation, responding to business combination proposals, and conducting internal investigations. So with no further ado, we'll begin with Chief Justice Vesey.
Thank you very much. That's a very nice introduction, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you to the Federalist Society for the invitation. My job is just to kind of set the stage for these smarter people than I am who are going to be talking about the getting down into the weeds of this issue. So I'm going to just try to give an overview. First, we begin with what do we mean by access? In its simplest form, it means that stockholders communicating with other stockholders to get a vote on something. But the way it's come out now in recent years, of course, is whose nickel is financing the access? And many activist institutional stockholders certainly want to get the corporation to do it and to put their access proposals into the proxy statement of the issuer. Subject to Rule 14A8, they can do it on their own nickel. They can, subject to the disclosure rules of the SEC, they can do it that way. But what they want to do is they want to get it into the company's proxy. Rule 14A8 governs what goes into the company's proxy, and there are a lot of precatory, non-binding resolutions that one sees often out there. And then there is the bylaw proposal, the mandatory bylaw. If the bylaw is valid under state law, there are some circumstances under which it can be excluded and other circumstances under which it can't, according to Rule 14A8. So the precatory proposal is kind of interesting because it doesn't have any analog in state law. It's an invention of the SEC, but it's quite common. It's been going on for a long time. And this access proposal really was driven by stockholders who wanted accountability of directors. And how do you get accountability? You put up your own candidates, you get the precatory vote, if it can go through the screen of 14A8, and so forth. And one of the most prevalent issues in recent years, up until now, about the accountability was majority voting. And now majority voting is quite prevalent. Indeed, it's become the norm. But let's go back to about 2003. The SEC had a proposal out there, Rule 14A8, which would have permitted stockholders to put up candidates on the proxy statement of the issuer under certain circumstances. And that is now on the table. Some commissioners have said it's dormant but not dead. But what that issue drove to me, and I went down along with other people and testified at the time, was a federalism point. Because it seemed to me that this was a matter of state law, what goes into the proxy statement. State law governs the internal affairs of corporations. And what really needed to be done was to address majority voting in state law. And that has been addressed. And there's been a sea change in majority voting. So that is now the norm under Delaware law. And there's a specific proposal in the Model Act to that effect. Now, the movement by some of the activist institutional shareholders to seek access now is going to the nominating procedure. And there was a proposal by AFSCME to set up a nominating procedure under a state bylaw. They proposed the mandatory state bylaw to the stockholders. And that was stopped by the SEC. But the Second Circuit came in the AFSCME case, AIG AFSCME case, and said, no, you can't exclude that under the way the SEC had approached this over the years, because the commission had never adopted the staff's position that setting up procedures under state bylaws was the equivalent of an issue relating to the election of directors. So that was the Second Circuit case, and that in turn triggered a lot of activity within the commission and elsewhere. So the commission then put up two conflicting proposals, one that would allow access under certain circumstances and others. Yeah, they were alternative proposals, and they were conflicting.
Right.
and they would have one would have permitted access under certain circumstances, and the other one would have excluded would have permitted exclusion of procedures for the nomination and election of directors. And the commission finally came down after a comment period and decided on the exclusion, but said that they would revisit it at another time. So let's then turn to Delaware. Delaware decided that it was a good idea to permit certification to the Delaware Supreme Court of questions of law propounded not only by federal district courts, federal courts of appeals, the highest court of other states, but also the SEC. So that the Constitution was amended in Delaware to permit that certification. And the SEC then certified a case to the Delaware Supreme Court about whether it was valid under state law to have a particular proposal permitting or requiring under certain circumstances the reimbursement of expenses of people who mounted proxy fights and the like. So the Delaware Supreme Court said, well, the bylaw itself relating to that issue is valid, but in this particular bylaw is invalid because it took the discretion, complete discretion, out of the hands of the directors. And under the Delaware statute, directors are charged with the responsibility for managing the affairs of the corporation. But the decision left some questions open for the future as to whether there might be a fiduciary out that would validate such a bylaw. So that case is out there. Not all the questions have been answered by that case. There are, however, at the end of the day, two overarching issues, and I'm going to stop with that because there are other people that want to talk about different issues. For example, there's Lucian Bebchuk's lawsuit about another particular proposal of a bylaw, and I think Professor Bainbridge is going to be talking about that. But the two overarching issues that I see here are, are we moving from a director-centric system of corporate governance where the directors are in charge of the business and affairs of the corporation? Or are we bleeding into a little bit more of a stockholder-centric basis, giving stockholders more and more say? Is that good or is that bad? Then the other question is the federalism question, because the internal affairs of corporations are it is necessary that the internal affairs of corporations be managed, be decided by the law of the state of incorporation, not the federal law, not by SEC fiat, not by anything else. Of course, Congress can come in and preempt state law, but that hasn't happened except in certain instances. Of course, Sarbanes-Oxley had some preemptive provisions that intruded on state law, but that has not done it. That has not resulted in a sweeping preemption of state corporation law. That would be a bad thing if that were to happen. Not only bad for Delaware, but I think it would be bad for investors and bad for the nation as a whole. I gave a speech to the American Law Institute, which you have in your materials, in which I talked about all these different issues that are coming before the courts and before the Congress on federal preemption and federalism. There are other bills in Congress that are problematic. And my concern is that there's no plan, there's no study that's been made about when it is a good policy to have a federal big foot on the issues or what the extent to which it should be left to state law. I have a particular bias on that, but I think it's something that really requires study so that we don't go bouncing from one cataclysm or paroxysm to another. And I think that I'll just leave that federalism point out there and retire for the moment. Thank you.
Professor Bainbridge?
Thank you. Let me begin by stressing my agreement with Chief Justice Veazey that those are the two big questions that shareholder access needs to grapple with. I have addressed those questions at some length in my latest book, The New Corporate Governance in Theory and Practice. And today what I want to do, though, instead of addressing those rather broad topics, is to focus in on a proposal that's been made by Harvard Law Professor Lucian Bebchuk, who has decided, I guess, to make a career for himself as a shareholder activist, and has been going around the country identifying companies where he makes various bylaw proposals, the most recent of which has been a proposal at video game manufacturer Electronic Arts, in which Bebchuk is using Rule 14a8 to put on EA's proxy statement for its upcoming shareholder meeting a proposal that basically would require the company to put a bylaw on the shareholder ballot, provided that the bylaw met certain minimal qualifications, and thus apparently preempt SEC Rule 14a8. I want to talk to you a little bit today about what might happen if the Bebchuk proposal were to pass. Let's assume the following scenario. The proposal passes, in response to which the board of directors of EA agrees to put to a shareholder vote an amendment to the Articles of Incorporation that would, in fact, require the company to put any qualifying bylaw on the shareholder ballot. And let's assume that that amendment to the articles then passes. We're now in a situation in which any proposal to amend the bylaws of the company that meets certain minimal requirements will have to go on to the ballot. What might happen next? Well, consider that sex and violence in video games is an issue that has attracted widespread attention. Pope Benedict XVI, for example, says that video games and other media that exalt violence and trivialize sexuality is a perversion, especially when directed at young people. Now bring onto the scene a wealthy social conservative like Tom Monahan, the founder of Domino's Pizza, who helped launch the Ave Maria funds, which are targeted investors seeking to place their money in companies whose operations are in keeping with the core teachings of the Catholic Church. The fund calls their shareholders socially responsible and morally responsible investors. And the fund sets certain religious criteria that screen companies before the funds invest in them. Suppose the Ave Maria funds decide to take a more proactive role in using the techniques of shareholder activism to pressure companies to stop making video games with sex and violence. Just as shareholder social activists long used Rule 14a8 to pressure companies to change their behavior on a wide range of social issues. In the absence of Bebchuk's proposal, it's uncertain whether the proposal could be excluded from the proxy statement were management to object. Management presumably would argue that there is a conflict between the Ave Maria proposal and the Board of Directors' powers under Section 141 of the Delaware Code, assuming we were dealing with a Delaware corporation, which would raise again the longstanding conflict between the bylaw provision of the Delaware Code, Section 109, and the general grant of authority to boards under Section 141, a conflict that was addressed in but not, I think, resolved in the CAV-AFSCME opinion that Justice Vesey referred to earlier. The company would also try to argue that the proposal could be excluded as a matter of ordinary business under 14a8i7, or perhaps as not a matter of economic significance under 14a8i5. The trouble with this is that the SEC has permitted, quote, socially significant proposals, such as tobacco company shareholders putting forward a proposal that the tobacco company stop advertising its products, on the shareholder ballot, on the proxy, because they have social significance, even though they involve what might otherwise be regarded as ordinary business of the company. Well, assume that the SEC sided with the company and said that the Ave Maria proposal could be excluded. Many proponents would give up on this at this point because they know going to court would be an expensive proposition, and going to court with the SEC having come down on the company's side is usually a losing battle. How would the process change were Bebchuk's proposal to pass? Well, in the first instance, I take it that the Bebchuk proposal is designed to get the SEC out of the business of refereeing what bylaws get into the shareholder ballot and what bylaws do not. Now, the board will argue that the funds are not a, quote, proper action for shareholders under state law, as required by Bebchuk's proposal. The company will argue that the proposal relates to the corporation's ordinary business operations. And the company might, as Bebchuk's proposal permits, exercise its fiduciary duties and conclude that the proposal would not be in the shareholders' best interest, and the board might then decide to exclude the proposal. Well, what happens next? If we've taken the SEC out of the process, as a referee, if the company decides to exclude the proposal, presumably the proponents will sue. What standard of review would apply? The business judgment rule, or because this is a matter affecting the franchise, Blasius? How much will the litigation cost the company? How long will the litigation take? Under the law in Delaware, shareholders can ask the Chancery Court to order a company to hold an annual stockholder meeting if more than 13 months have passed since the last one. But what if the litigation is preventing the company from completing a definitive proxy statement to disseminate to shareholders? We have seen recently that the Delaware courts are willing to order companies to hold their annual meeting, even though the company has not yet been able to get an annual report to the shareholders out under the SEC rules. And so the Delaware courts are not treating your inability to comply with SEC rules as justification for a delay in holding your annual report. And before you tell me this is a bogus problem, let me remind you of the long history of social activists using shareholder proposals to effect social change. The Bebchuk proposal, it seems to me, simply makes it even easier for such activists to pursue their goals, even though those goals may have very little to do with the good of the company. We might also ask whether people might try to use the Bebchuk proposal in a way to pursue private rent seeking. There's been a lot of debate about what the identity of shareholder activists is and what their particular goals are. And we do know that there tends to be overrepresentation among shareholder activists of state and local pension funds and union pension funds, which often are seeking their private rents as opposed to something that's necessarily to the advantage of all the shareholders. Will that be accelerated by the Bebchuk process? Suffice it to say that once we open the door to increased shareholder access, we're going to get a lot of additional proposals, like the Bebchuk proposal at Electronic Arts, that raise very serious and fundamental questions and potentially change the nature of corporate governance in the ways that Chief Justice Vesey was describing. But I see that my co-panelists are eager to get started, so I'll stop now and give them an opportunity to talk.
We're actually chatting about which of the many Lucian Bebchuk proposals you're focusing on. This is the Electronic Arts one, right?
Yes.
He has a proposal du jour, it seems.
We'll move next to Damon Silvers from the AFL-CIO.
Thank you. First, let me apologize for being late. In case you may not have noticed, I'm sure you all have, it's a rather strange and busy day in Washington today, particularly for those of us who have some responsibility in our jobs for things relating to the financial markets. I hope, Professor Bainbridge, I haven't cut you off in midstream, and if we have, we'll give you a chance to finish in a moment. I've been asked today, I believe, to discuss the question of what role shareholders should play in director elections, which is an issue that has been hotly debated over the last, it comes and goes over the last 100 years, but it's been particularly hot since Enron and WorldCom in 2002. And I want to make a series of observations about that. I've always found that the Federalist Society is a place where, A, you get some vigorous debate, at least when I show up, and that, B, there's a certain level of intellectual seriousness here, and I'm going to hopefully at least hit the minimum. First, I think this is, before I get into the various specific ideas that have been broached and some of their implications, I want to make an observation about this issue that has grown on me with increased seriousness over the time, over the years that I've been involved in it. And that is that, and it's particularly, I think, relevant in, frankly, you know, a relatively conservative and pro-business-oriented setting such as this one. I believe those are not, some of the people I talk to would view that as those are disparaging terms. I don't think they're seen that way here. This question is a question that has subtleties and depth that, while well appreciated in the Delaware courts, are often not well appreciated anywhere else. And in particular, if one is thinking about this from the perspective of how do we have a well-functioning economy, how do we have businesses do what they should do, which is create wealth, what is the right balance between shareholders and the management of the firm? There is a view that one often hears in investor circles that the management of the firm, the board, and particularly the managers, are pure agents, meaning that shareholders own the firm in the sense that, you know, I own my toothbrush, and that really the job of management is to do as they are told. This point of view is generally associated with the view that the best source of information as to how to govern a company is whatever signals emerge from the capital markets, and on a relatively short-term basis from the capital markets. That is one point of view, and it is adhered to by people who are often very staunch advocates of property rights, people whom in many respects view themselves as, I would say, perhaps libertarian conservatives. There is another view, which is the view that, and I think this is more the view that comes from a close reading of the Delaware law, there is a view that this is not a sort of pure agency relationship in the crude way I just described, that a board are, in a sense, independent fiduciaries. They are to exercise their judgment, that management is sort of an extension of that in a way, and that hopefully that the management and the board are, that the shareholders do not own the corporation in the way that one owns a toothbrush, that they own shares, that those shares have certain rights, but among them is not the right to put the corporation in your pocket and walk away with it, to be metaphorical. Now, what goes along with that is that some view about information advantage. You really, if you embrace this kind of view, you really have to believe at some level that boards and managers know something that the public, the trading markets do not know. These are the two views that tend to, when big arguments get going, these are the two views that tend to get played out, often not terribly transparently. And each view, in my opinion, has some merit. Right? Neither view is in their extreme forms, I think neither view is correct. But they embody some truth to them about the way our economy works and about the way our legal system both does and should work. Now, and I would suggest, and this is sort of the way I see it, I wouldn't say that I, in speaking here today, speak necessarily for the AFL-CIO does not have a treatise on corporate law, and neither do all unions or all pension funds agree on what I'm going to say. I'm just me speaking. But the way I see it is like this, that there are information advantages. Managers, if you don't have a management team that knows more about the business than the public at large, you need to get a different one. All right? And that markets, while they have a lot of pluses to them, are not in any sense perfect in the way that certain finance theorists suggest that they might have been 20 years ago, except over a time frame that's not really relevant, which, by the way, is what the meaning of Keynes's famous remark is. And thus, the notion of pure agency or that shareholders own stocks where they own toothbrushes is just the wrong way of thinking about this. However, that does not mean that what we have is a kind of virtual representation here in which the best way to do things is to have investors be seen and not heard, or perhaps neither seen nor heard, an arrangement in which there simply is no accountability to anyone. Right? That can't be the right answer either. And that in many ways the type of accountability that some investors advocate, which is the accountability of being very tightly tied to short-term stock price movements in terms of executive compensation and incentives, and being completely open, right, to the takeover markets, is not necessarily a system that is going to be well designed to maximize the information advantages that hopefully your management has. On the other hand, a sort of autarkic system, a system that's closed off from accountability and oversight, is one that's likely where it's likely to be one where principal-agent problems become quite severe. Now, how do these general insights relate to the? Oh, and by the way, one more point: all investors are not the same. They're not the same in terms of time horizons. They're not the same in terms of their economic position. If we learn anything as a sort of polity from the events of the last couple of years, we ought to have learned that derivatives count, right? That you can do pretty much any, that you, all kinds of things can be under the surface in what appears to be a financial market of buyers and sellers of securities. The last 2 weeks have been one hell of a lesson in that. Now we have three ideas about how what the relationship between shareholders and boards ought to be in terms of the shareholder role in picking boards. Now, the first idea, maybe there's four ideas. There's sort of the status quo anti-Enron, which was not, shareholder role in picking boards, not very much outside of a full corporate control context. I mean, obviously, the statutes and Delaware law give shareholders the right to vote on candidates, but in practicality, if you weren't prepared to run a full contest, you weren't prepared to spend major money, which generally you didn't do unless you had a control strategy, you're just kind of not participating. Second idea, which has gained a lot of traction, is majority voting. Majority voting means that if the investors choose not to vote yes on you and vote and either withhold their vote or vote no, they withhold their vote in the way that the SEC proxy is designed. If a majority of shareholders, not having an alternative candidate but just not liking you, vote against you, you can't be seated. Now the mechanisms for that vary and have more and less teeth in them, but that's the concept. And of course, majority voting is combined in reality with withhold campaigns by investors. And any investor can run a withhold campaign. In fact, a non-investor can run one. You just start communicating with those shareholders saying this person shouldn't be on your board. The second idea, which has been floated at various times by Charles Ellison at the University of Delaware and by Lucian, whom I guess we've heard quite a bit about, and by AFSCME in the case that I believe Chief Justice Vesey discussed before I arrived, is the idea that there should be reimbursement, that if shareholders incur some costs in running candidates for the board, they ought to be reimbursed for those costs. Now, the legality of a binding bylaw to provide for reimbursement as a shareholder proposal in Delaware was recently litigated, and the precise words in that proposal were found not to be proper under Delaware law for reasons I believe has already been discussed, and I won't repeat unless they haven't been discussed. But the concept of reimbursement is around. The concept of reimbursement, you get reimbursed in proportion, generally viewed as in proportion to the votes you get. Again, like majority voting...
That proposal would have provided for full reimbursement if you succeeded in electing even one director.
So there's, like I said, there's different ways of cutting this, but the concept is reimbursement from the corporate
treasury.
And it gave
no discretion to the board in making a decision that in a particular case it wasn't in the interest of the corporation to do that.
And that's why it was knocked down.
Right.
Right. And that raises a whole bunch of very interesting legal questions about the understanding of fiduciary duty in Delaware law, but the point about reimbursement is, again, it's a proposal that – it's a concept, right, that is kind of open. Any shareholder, any candidate – perhaps that was some of the court's concern, the concern underlying the doctrine. Then the third concept is the one that has gotten the most political heat and that the business community has fought, you know, really pretty vigorously. Reimbursement has kind of been around the margins, and I'm not sure what the views of the business community, the organized business community, are about the relative painfulness of that versus other ideas. But the third idea is what's called proxy access, which is that and this gets into the federalism issues, that there is a federal rule governing the content of public companies' proxies that under some terms requires some candidates to be on the management proxy together with the management candidates. All the concepts around proxy access that have been in front of the SEC have involved requirements that you hold a certain amount of stock, requirements that the stock be held for a certain period of time, and those time periods vary, and other requirements. There are requirements that there first be a majority withhold occur at the company. There have been a variety of other thoughts about that.
And proxy access has raised the concern from the business community. I mean, business community is very strongly opposed to proxy access, and has raised the issue that it may be, without congressional action, an infringement upon the prerogatives of the states under the BRT case that pretty much defined that substantive corporate law is a state matter unless and until Congress says it isn't. What I would like to point out is that this is sort of ironic, because I think when you look at a lot of what's going on over the last couple of years and the business community's unhappiness with the role that, say, hedge funds have played, and the sort of the old-fashioned term of green mail, which now takes place in the context of, share, of stock buybacks, more generalized stock buybacks, and various kinds of gaming around the way that short-term market prices react and the relative ability of some actors to get out of their positions faster than others. When you look at that, governance provisions that have no entrance requirements, these strike me as ones that are more harmful to people who believe in the kind of managerial paradigm that I talked about earlier than those that do have some entrance requirements. And yet the business community's perspective has been to be far more hostile about provisions that have entrance requirements than those that don't. That strikes me as odd. On behalf of workers and their pension funds, my view, or maybe I shouldn't say on behalf of, thinking about workers and their pension funds, because, again, this is just, I'm just talking here, not expressing policy positions. Thinking about workers and their pension funds, we are concerned when very short-term oriented investors start driving corporate governance. Right? That's a problem for us because we are long-term investors. Right? Well, whatever happens after the hedge fund gets their stock buyback, that's the world we're going to live in as investors. And so we would prefer things that have some entrance requirements. Entrance requirements both in terms of the size of the holding and in terms of the longevity of the holding. But we also think that it's very important that there should be some way of there being accountability, and that the accountability ought to be about who is on the board, not about trying to usurp the role of the board. Right? And here's another thing you may be surprised by. I don't believe that we ought to run corporations by plebiscite. I think that we ought to have a way, we ought to have ways in which investors can be heard, and some rules and some structures, but I don't think we ought to run companies by plebiscite as a general matter. Now, what that means is that who's on the board becomes extremely important. And it should not be necessary for investors to actually want to take control of a company to be able to have a voice as to who's on the board so that there's some independent judgment being reflected there. And in the context of the financial crisis, let me just end by reflecting on some things that are sort of current. In the context of the financial crisis, I've had the opportunity to talk to a number of boards about, you know, kind of how things went wrong. And without betraying anybody's confidences, I will say that it continues to be the case that boards, even when they're composed of very capable people, are inherently institutions where there is deference given to management. And that the degree of deference has diminished, but that deference still exists. That deference has a lot of positive aspects to it, if you think about the information issues I alluded to earlier. But there needs to be limits to that deference, and there needs to be an ability to put people into boards who are really going to look at things from an independent perspective. I'm not real thrilled about the idea of making it easy to put people on the board who are looking at it from the perspective of somebody who's got a big position that they're going to wipe away with a derivatives trade in 10 minutes. Right? That just doesn't seem to me to be in the public interest.
So you should have filed an amicus brief in support of CSX in that case?
Well, let's put it this way. we watched that case with some interest and had some impact on who did file an amicus brief. Let me conclude there. I think that
sure.
Lays out the way we think about this and hopefully is responsive to the task set before me.
Batting cleanup will be John Olson.
Well, let me note, first of all, I'm very pleased to have been invited once again to the Federalist Society, despite the fact that I'm a lifelong Democrat. I always thought that they sent the invitation to the wrong Olson at Gibson, Dun & Crutcher, but it turns out I actually do know something about this topic. And Ted sends his regards. Other thing I would say is that despite my political affiliation, as Damon knows, I have for many years represented the Business Roundtable, which is a more bipartisan group than he and others would lead you to believe. In any event, and I don't speak for them. I'm here on my own, and I have not discussed these comments with any of my clients, many of whom have conflicting views as to these issues. I also would say that I think most of us on this panel, although we come from different perspectives, are in fairly violent agreement. We agree, I think, that a corporation is not a general partnership. We agree, and Damon said this very well, that shareholders are not the owners of the corporation. They own shares of stock in the corporation. Indeed, in many large corporations and sometimes smaller ones, there are many classes of shares of stock. There's voting stock and non-voting stock and preferred stock of various series and classes. And then let's not forget the people that have convertible debentures and warrants and options, which can turn into equity at their desire or be called by the company and turned into equity. And if the company gets into financial trouble, the teaching of the Delaware courts is that at least once insolvency occurs, and maybe even before, the directors have a duty to think about those folks. And that leads to the question of the agency principle, which Damon discussed very well, and I would just say I agree with that. When Norm Vesey and I have served for a good many years on the Committee on Corporate Laws, which drafts and updates the Model Business Corporation Act, which is the basic model for the statute, not in 30-some states, I guess, Norm, not Delaware, but in many other states, we've come to the conclusion, I think, as a group, that the directors owe their duty to the well-being of the enterprise, not to any particular class of owners of securities issued by the enterprise. They owe a duty of loyalty and a duty of care to the a duty of good faith to the health of the enterprise, which will have various kinds of claims on it by various kinds of people who hold stock and debt and so on and so forth. So, and Damon points out quite rightly that the owners of the enterprise these days may fractionate their rights so that some have economic value through various kinds of equity swaps with no actual title or ability to vote, but perhaps great ability to influence the vote, and others have title and the right to vote and have, through the use of derivatives, eliminated any economic exposure. And we're just beginning to learn how to deal in that kind of an environment. With that background, we all, I think, agree with Professor Bainbridge's very trenchant comments about the series of corporate populism proposals, which I commented in the Virginia Law Review article that's in the materials here, put out over the last several years by Lucian Bebchuk, which proceed on the theory that shareholders are the owners and ought to be able to, through referenda and proxy contests and access and anything else Lucian can think of, have the ability to, on a fairly granular basis, direct the business and affairs of the corporation. I think, and I think hearing my colleagues on the panel, all of us think that doesn't work. That's not what a corporation is. Moving Chief Justice Vesey's very thoughtful comments, and he did a great history of what's going on in this area, state law is very important. And by tradition and by constitution in this country, state law is dominant unless the federal government exercising a power granted to it in the Constitution. You guys know this. This is your gospel. You have this under your pillow, you know, Federalist Papers and that stuff, and the Constitution itself. You know, Ted carries one in his back pocket at all times. He really does. This is not I didn't make that up. So you know that the states retain all powers that are not expressly granted to the federal government. There is a commerce power, and there's no question, we think, that the government could set up some kind of a national law for some corporations. But 75 or 80, maybe 90% of the corporations in the United States are privately held. They're not traded in the public markets. There are hundreds of thousands of them are set up for family businesses, for small businesses. And the state corporation statutes, which we think are so important, govern all of those enterprises as well as the big ones listed on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ market. I don't think any of us thinks that we ought to have a federal law for corporations. The question that's interesting is how much federal law should there be for publicly traded corporations that are traded across state lines and in international commerce on the major stock markets. And that's the area we're talking about. And I think so. I think my colleagues have focused us very properly on what those key issues are that underline this discussion of so-called proxy access. Now, what is proxy access? Well, the proxy access proposals, which Damon summarized a moment ago, can be all characterized, by me anyway, as proxy access for the mighty and powerful. The smallest percentage that's been proposed that I've heard of anybody remotely responsible is that you'd have to have 1% of the voting power in order to put forth a nominee, and you might have to have some triggers before that happens. And Damon talked about having limited access so that not just everybody can name a nominee. We do not want to have a free-for-all where you can have a ballot where 500 nominees and any shareholder wants to nominate. But think about that a second. The proposal was made by the SEC was at 5%. They indicated some indication to go down to 3%. In a large company, that's a lot of stock. That's a lot of value, and you can put a group together to have it. I know that at one point in the panel I was with you or with Rich on, Damon, you said that there wasn't any one of your pension funds that had that much stock in 95% of the American public companies, if not close to 100%. So you'd have to bring a group together. So this is access for large shareholders, including people like Carl Icahn and others who go out and acquire a large stake using a private equity fund or a hedge fund. It's not access for you and me, certainly not for me anyway. I don't think I own more than about $100,000 worth of stock in any company, and that's a
3% of
excellent. And that's a big and that's a big position for me, and that's 1/100 of 1% of whatever the corporation is. So I don't have proxy access under any proposal. This is not shareholder democracy. It's something else. What it really is an opportunity for activists, including groups of pension funds who may get together, and people like, as you said earlier, the Ave Maria funds, if they want to bring some people together, who want to shake things up in the boardroom and make their influence felt and perhaps get somebody elected. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'll leave that to your judgment. But it's not corporate democracy. It's not direct democracy. It's something else. It's leverage for big investors or groups of investors. And we can spend a lot of time talking about that's good or bad, but that's what it is. Interestingly enough, there is a halfway house provision that the SEC adopted some years ago, item 407 of Regulation SK. Look it up. It says that if any shareholder or group of shareholders having 5% of the voting power of the company for a year or more propose a candidate for nomination to the nominating committee of the board of directors, the corporation has to disclose the fact that that proposal has been made, give the name of the nominee, and indicate what action the nominating committee of the board took with respect to that proposal. Guess what? Not one single investor or group of investors has ever taken advantage of that provision in the 4 or 5 years it's been on the books. Not one. So is shareholder access for the rich and powerful the threat to our system as we know it that some of my clients might claim? I think not. Is it a good idea in terms of making influence on the selection of directors available to responsible investors who are concerned about the direction of the company? I have my doubts. Is it good governance? Is it consistent with federalism? For large publicly traded companies, it's perfectly consistent with federalism if the Congress wants to enact a statute doing that. And guess what? In the last 48 hours, and that's why Damon was late, he and his colleagues have been up on the Hill. And this is last night's midnight version of the draft House version of the bailout bill, which is the same as the Senate version in this respect, I'm told, though I haven't seen the Senate version. And it says that if you want to sell to the new bailout facility that's going to be administered by the Treasury with whatever oversight the Congress decides, there is a requirement that the selling financial institution permit any shareholder or group of shareholders holding in the aggregate equity securities of the institution representing 3% or more of the equity securities of the institution access to the proxy solicitation and shareholder vote for any election of the board of directors of the institution for the purposes of nominating and electing a designated individual to the board of directors of the institution. Just a brief professorial or lawyer's comment on the drafting. I don't know what the heck 3% of what is. So 3% of the equity securities, I suppose, literally means you count up all the securities that are out there, including all the non-voting preferreds and every other class. And if you have 3% of the number of shares outstanding, you can nominate, I think it means one candidate because it says A, it doesn't mean an individual. But maybe they meant 3% of the voting power, which would be only voting securities, or maybe they'd mean 3% of the market cap. Obviously, some refinement. I don't see anything in here that gives the SEC the power to make rules to implement this, but I suspect they'll get smart enough to put that in there at some point, otherwise it won't work. But the idea is that, along with say on pay and a limit on any kind of severance payments, any kind of golden parachutes, is the quid pro quo that at the moment, Congressman Frank, who's chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and at least Senator Dodd's staff on the Senate side, I'm not so sure that Chris Dodd himself has bought into this, are saying is the price for Secretary Paulson and the administration getting their bailout authority. Now, that, it seems to me, is a constitutional matter. Oops. Bow to Judge Kavanaugh if he wants to comment on that. Maybe he can't because it may come before his court. But or to Professor Bainbridge or former Chief Justice Veazey, who could certainly comment. I think it's constitutional. I mean, if the Congress decides they want to make that a condition of taking advantage of this federal thing and apply it to companies, and note it doesn't limit it to public companies. It's any financial institution that's got to do this. It would be interesting if it's a financial institution that has 10 shareholders. But in any event, I think that's constitutional. Is it wise? No. Is it appropriate with this kind of a bailout? Not in my judgment, but there it is. And in addition to that, as I say, there would also be a limit on parachutes and a requirement that each of these institutions who come as a mendicant to this facility to sell their bad loans or bad properties to the also have to annually provide for a say-on-pay advisory resolution. So it's sort of good governance coming in through the federal back door. What does that tell you? Well, it tells me, and both, as far as I can tell, it's hard to tell what presidential candidate McCain stands for because it seems to change with each speech, but it is clear, I mean, in this area, I don't mean generally, I mean, he's a wonderful man, but in the governance area, he seems to say much of the time that he favors say on pay, that he favors limits on excessive executive compensation, that he favors these provisions. I don't know that he's spoken directly on proxy access, but I wouldn't bet that in either a McCain or an Obama administration, we will have continued pressure at the federal level to impose proxy access in some form, at least on those corporations that want to come and get a federal helping hand in this area or others. And I think that's as much of a summation as I can do.
Well, we're going to look to the audience here for questions, so I'll be looking out for you. But I thought I would ask Professor Bainbridge on the federalism issue generally to comment on what you've heard and where you think the proper balance is struck here in the between the federal and state roles.
Well, it's nearly certain. So let's start off by remembering that the people that are drafting this bailout legislation are the very same people who blocked the 2005 Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac reform legislation. Chris Dodd was the ringleader of the block of the of preventing the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac reform legislation.
I always thought Bernie Frank was
getting out of the committee, and Chris Dodd is also the single largest recipient of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac campaign contributions. And yet, he's the one that's going to save our financial system. This is one reason why I prefer to leave it to Delaware. Delaware has competition. Competitive federalism works. Every study except by Lucian Bebchuk or one of his acolytes that has ever been undertaken suggests that Delaware tends to adopt efficient solutions to corporate governance problems. And the reason is Delaware has 49 competitors that would be happy to take a slice of its franchise tax business away from it. Delaware knows that. This is why Delaware does things like send half a dozen or so people to sit on the Model Business Corporation Act so that if the MBCAs, the Committee on Corporate Laws that we both sit on, It's full of Delaware agents who I think must run back to Delaware the minute the corporate, the committee comes up with a good idea and get it passed in Delaware. You know, federalism works in this area. We've had, you know, years of experience in this area. And basically there's no reason to think that, you know, writing legislation at midnight as the financial system's going down the tubes by the very same people who brought us the problem in the first place is better than leaving it to the good folks in the Delaware judiciary and bar.
John Olson, you want to...
I just want to make a comment about what seems to be a very strange to me vendetta against Chris Dodd, former longtime Republican congressman from Cox, I mean, Chris Cox, many-term Republican congressman from California, now chairman of the SEC for the last 3 years. And I think Chris may even be a member of this group. I don't know, Chris Cox. But he doesn't start with, at least publicly, with Senator McCain, and now I'm hearing it from Professor Bainbridge. What, Chris Dodd was not sharing.
I didn't say anything about Chris Cox. I was talking about Chris Dodd.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, there's been a demonization of Chris Cox, which makes it seem like the two Chris's are the same. And in particular, he's McCain's been blaming him for somehow letting all this happen. More, and certainly more to the point, to blame Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. But this latest statement about Cox somehow being responsible for the failure of our major financial institutions because the SEC wasn't tough enough on regulation strikes me as just plain bizarre. The SEC does not regulate banks. It does not regulate Fannie and Freddie with respect to their safeness and soundness. It does not have the power of the purse or the ability to disperse any funds. And although, as I said earlier, I'm a Democrat, I said sometimes we just do strange things. Chris Dodd, fair enough. He was a protector of Fannie and Freddie. On the other hand, this administration didn't lift a finger, despite strong calls for action by very prescient people like Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute, who I have to admit is my former law partner, but he's a wonderful guy. He's been calling for more than a decade for reining in those organizations, and neither the Reagan nor the Clinton administration has responded to that call.
Damon Silvers, you want to respond to Professor Bainbridge on federalism works in this area or any other comments you have?
Sure. You can say nice things about Delaware because you clerked for Chancellor Allen.
I generally try to say nice things about Delaware whenever I'm given a microphone. I think it's a little bit strange to be talking about what works at this particular moment. A lot of things seem not to have worked and not to have worked in really big ways. I think that the Delaware corporate law has many virtues, and I think I alluded to some of them in my earlier remarks in terms of the sophistication of the thinking about the relationship between boards and stockholders, and how much is packed into a phrase like a duty of loyalty owed to the shareholders and the corporation, a phrase that's very deep in its meaning and interpretation. I think that we have had a balance in the way in which we deal with corporate governance in its largest sense. Not in the sense that the Supreme Court meant in the BRT case, but in the sense that encompasses the public proxy solicitation and the internal rules that are in the state law. The question of how boards are elected is right on the fulcrum of that balance, because it both involves the content of the publicly distributed proxy and what's there, the set of relationships in Delaware between that govern the substantive conduct of the state law election. And I think you can see that in the way in which the set of issues that I described in my initial comments have played out over the last few years, as they played out both in Delaware and in Washington. The
proxy access issue is fundamentally an issue of what is on the proxy, proxy access. And I think that there's really no problem with that being a matter of federal regulation. And not surprisingly, I've spent a lot of my time the last few years at the SEC advocating that. Now, it could be done in a different way, right? There have really been two ideas in front of the commission. One has been the idea of regulating directly through the placement of candidates on the public proxy, on the public company proxy. The other idea, which got a lot of attention a year or so ago, was the idea of including proxy access as an issue subject to the 14A8 shareholder proposal rule, which is, in fact, if you're worried that somehow that kind of direct intervention that the first idea has is a problem. The second idea is much more clearly, if you talk about that fulcrum, clearly over on the federal side in terms of the impacting the shareholder proposal rule. I want to make I don't see this as raising a fundamental issue of federal and state prerogatives in either case, but I do point out that I think there are different ways of cutting it that occupy different places on that continuum. Now, I do want to, though, say a word or two about this notion of sort of who's at fault here. Because this conversation is occurring under this giant cloud.
In this town,
right? and people kind of come from where I'm coming from are really, you know, we have this real issue with the notion that we're going to spend some enormous amount of the public's money, it's a little unclear exactly how much, on a program of rescuing private companies. By the way, something's got to be done. I don't mean to suggest that doing nothing is really an option here. But that we're going to do all this, and then we're going to pretend that this constitutes a free market. I mean, that really doesn't seem to wash at all, and has all kinds of implications for public policy more generally, which people I represent feel very, very strongly about. But on the question of, you know, Fannie and Freddie say and this and that, I think we ought not to kid ourselves here. The Fannie and Freddie run the conforming mortgage market. The conforming mortgage market has deteriorated in this situation, but the conforming mortgage market is not what has caused the financial crisis. Right? Fannie and Freddie got greedy and bought into the non-conforming mortgage market. And they got greedy because of some of the in ways that are connected with some of the issues we're talking about today. Right? The governance of Fannie and Freddie, at least in my opinion, was not structured in a way that met very well the purposes that Fannie and Freddie were serving. And we had some really kind of moral hazard problems in relation to people having upside exposure and not downside exposure. But Fannie and Freddie were taken down because of the complete collapse of the subprime market, which was the unregulated part of the market predominantly, which they really had nothing to do with. That was not fundamentally them. And I think that's, you know, I think we've got to face it, that's what happened.
On the governance of Fannie and Freddie, a large number of the directors of both of those institutions by charter were to be named by the President of the United States. And presumably that would represent the public interest and the government's interest related to the implicit guarantee into their federal position in the mortgage markets. For reasons that I understand, but which I think you can now think about, this administration declined to name any presidential appointees. So those boards went forward through the last 8 years with no presidential appointees on the board. That was, I think, because there were people in the White House who philosophically did not believe that this sort of mixed public-private enterprise, as you said, that public risk of private profit made any sense.
So where are those people now?
They
shipped them off somewhere.
They weren't named to board, so there are vacancies.
I'm just talking about the rather larger venture into mixed public and private enterprise that we're about to embark on.
No, exactly. Well, and we're talking about monitoring now. So it's not just that the governance was flawed. It was that I think the philosophy – there was a debate which was never resolved as to what kind of enterprises these were. And it's one where everybody shares responsibility I think the responsibility also goes beyond Fannie and Freddie into the marketplace. The appetite for of the investment banks for product, which was securitized and was supposedly limited risk by having bigger piles of the same kinds of things, and a government policy which was strongly supported by Alan Greenspan through all of the presidents he served, of encouraging home ownership by people who otherwise couldn't afford it by having loans available on all sorts of unique bases, came together. And I think Fannie and Freddie, as you said, they tried to join the party because they didn't want to miss the opportunity to make money, but they were not the original generators of these trends. It was government policy set at the highest level in which both political parties were active participants, and it went through at least 16 years of administrations.
Let me ask Chief Justice Vesey what you think the current crisis in the markets, financial crisis, says to the precise issue before us, or more broadly to the general structure of corporate governance.
Well, I'm concerned about that, the entire picture of the finances, of course, and I've enjoyed listening to the experts debate it back and forth about who's at fault and how it should be done.
That's what we do in Washington.
Yeah. But the thing that concerns me is the same thing that I mentioned earlier that's in my American Law Institute speech, is, and that is every scandal, every crisis is an invitation to Congress to legislate in an area where they probably ought not to be dabbling too far. For example, intrusion into the internal affairs of corporations. They did it in Sarbanes-Oxley. They could have been much worse in that regard in Sarbanes-Oxley. John has mentioned some in the House bill there about access and about executive compensation and say on pay and limits on parachutes and that kind of thing. That may be an appropriate deal-making situation here, but it's another paroxysm of the Congress, and it could lead to a lot of mischief down the road in terms of principles of federalism. So that's a matter of concern. I haven't read the provisions relating to those. I'm sure John has them here. I can only imagine what they are. So the camel's nose can be in the tent in this crisis in connection with federalism, and what's the next step of Congress intruding into state law? That's what concerns me.
You know, can I just go ahead? A brief comment on this. Some of these issues may or may not be, as Chief Justice Vesey put it, intrusions into state law as a general matter. But I think we do need to keep an eye on what is going on, at least in regard to this giant bailout, which is that the public is being asked to be the rescuer of an undefined number of private businesses. And, you know, when somebody, anyone, is asked to rescue a private business with their own money, right, conditions come with that, right? And whether today, at this particular instance, they've got exactly the right mix of conditions, I would hesitate to say. Right? It'd be a dangerous thing to express an opinion on, because it certainly changed from the document that John has and the documents that I've seen already. But there's nothing, I think, that has any constitutional implications in the public when the public's money is being asked to essentially ask as
I didn't
as
say
the rest
it was unconstitutional.
No, policy. Right, but what I'm what I mean is I don't think it raises the. Where everyone thinks the line is, where it's unwise for right. Congress to step across it, right, in terms of the general regulation of the corporate form, right? And I think there's some feeling, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I think I've certainly known people who felt that there should be no such line. But I think there's some reluctance to erase that line, right? I'm part of almost everyone who's interested in corporate governance. Whatever
it's
you think,
it's a blurred line,
right? Whatever one thinks about all those issues, the question of the public asserting some essentially some covenants, right?
which might be very substantive, of the kind that one would not generally wish to impose upon all corporations at the federal level. The question of the public asserting some covenants with the public's money going into business enterprises as a, this kind of open-ended bailout of various business enterprises is nothing more than any of us would do in our private affairs were it our money alone. And I don't think it. Now, getting it right is another question, right? But that's that's business. One of the extraordinary things about this moment is that, and maybe I'm wrong about this room, but one of the extraordinary things about this moment is that there's almost no one who expresses their thoughts in terms of policies and so forth that thinks that we ought not to do something of this of the sort that's being debated right now in Washington. That as someone once said, there are no atheists in foxholes, and there are no real free marketeers in a financial crisis.
Any questions from the audience? Yeah, we have one over here.
J.W. Verrett, I teach at George Mason Law School, and before that I clerked in the Delaware Court of Chancery, and before that I was a research assistant for Lucian Bebchuk. So at discussions like this, I kind of feel like a bit of a wishbone. But it does...
You've lived the life of a wishbone.
Yeah, and in fact, my replacement was Marty Lipton's daughter, so I'm sure she probably feels worse. But it does leave me with a question. Why have we seen no discussion of, in terms of attempts at compromise, or just attempts to sort of, we see access on the horizon. We want to sort of head it off at the pass and get some compromise that will limit some of the damage that we've heard about on the panel. Why have we seen no discussion of the plurality voting standard in Delaware for contested elections? I wonder if we could deal with the divisive social activist problem and at the same time deal with the accountability mechanisms that we've heard about today by changing the plurality standard for contested elections, not the majority vote withhold votes we talked about, but for contested elections, through some sort of a majority vote mechanism. Now, I know you would come back at me and say runoffs would be hard to have in corporate elections, but why don't we just have a preferential ballot? It doesn't seem you'd have to change the proxy machinery that much to have a preference vote. That way, nominees would have to convince the Fidelities and the Teocrafts of the world that hold the big chunks in companies, and it seems like it would be a compromise. But perhaps you don't like my idea, but at the end of the day, I guess my real question is, why no compromise? Why no revisiting of the plurality voting standard for contested elections, which seems to be really at the heart of the matter to me? Is there any way to head Barney Frank off at the pass with something along these lines? I guess this is my question to the panel.
In the short run, I don't think there's any way to head Barney off at the pass. If he's headed off at the pass, it's going to be because a majority made up of Republicans and moderate Democrats decides this is not the time to deal with this at the middle of this bailout thing. It's not because anything we can do fast enough in Delaware or anywhere else. With respect to the idea of modifying the plurality standard for a contest, that isn't a compromise that's ever appealed to anybody because nobody favors it. The activists don't favor it because they want to have a plurality in contested situations because then they have the opportunity of getting some representation on the board. And they wouldn't want to have majority voting in a contest. And no proposal I know of calls no form of majority voting that's supported by the activist groups calls for plurality voting in a contest. In fact, ISS risk metrics will recommend against a proposal that doesn't carve out contests and preserve plurality voting for that. And I think that remains the provision in Delaware, Norm.
Yes.
I don't think there's any.
Right.
So there's essentially no constituency for that particular compromise. The business community's opposition to compromise, I think, at least some aspects of the business community, not everybody has the same view, and not everybody in the business community thinks this is the biggest threat in the world, but those that oppose it, it's partly theological. It's partly, Campbell's nose and the tent. Some of the things that Chief Justice Feasey said, once the federal government starts telling people how to conduct elections, what's going to come next? They're going to decide to talk about qualifications of directors. Are they going to talk about other things which are best left to state law and where the federal government's never intruded? So it's theological partly, and it's partly just not wanting to give additional leverage to people including those represented by Damon, but also activist hedge funds and social action groups and the like, and they see this as a step down the road toward doing that.
Well, if I could follow up on that, I think that one of the problems that business has is, and one of the problems I have with proxy access is you have to ask the question, who? You know, who's going to be using these tools? Whom are we empowering? Because it is clear that not all shareholders are equally interested in using these tools. And when you look at the groups that do, they tend to be, number one, the social activists who really don't have the corporation's best interests in mind but rather have some other social agenda. Secondly, it's people like Carl Icahn for whom this is another tool in doing corporate control contests or what have you. And then thirdly, it's state and local union pension funds, which have whatever their agenda may be. And so, you know, you look at these three constituencies, none of which, if I was running a business, I would not perceive any of those three groups as necessarily being, you know, who my mythical shareholder is or the person that I'm concerned with running the business on behalf of. And so I think it's partly the identities of the people that would be empowered that is the concern in the business community here.
You know, I'd like to respond to that for moment, but I'd also like to respond to your question about compromise, because there have been a variety of efforts at compromise around the larger issue of director elections. Some people viewed majority voting as a compromise. Some people have offered reimbursement as a compromise. The business community has more or less accepted majority voting, I would say. But it doesn't achieve, I think, it achieves in some ways more, in some ways less, for at least as I see it. I'm not saying that I'm against it. I'm just saying that it's different than proxy access. There have then been a number of suggestions around proxy access itself. Right? Many different formulations of proxy access were discussed during the 2003-2004 rulemaking period, many different ones. What they had in common and what we supported, the FLCIO institutionally, was the notion that, and I think this was part of your question, was the notion that this ought not to be something that someone who bought 10 shares yesterday ought to be able to use. And whether that, as John says, is that shareholder democracy, is that big people being powerful? I mean, you know, one of the things that happens in the governance of companies is that people with more money are more powerful. That's kind of how it works.
It's the golden rule. Those have the gold make the rules.
Right. So, I mean, one may disagree with that as a concept, but this certainly didn't begin and end here. But one idea built into all those discussions was the idea that it's important that before anyone actually nominates a candidate, that they have real broad support. And some of the percentage thresholds that were discussed had that in mind, that you couldn't really get there without a Fidelity or a Vanguard or somebody on the theory that whether your particular view of the bad actor here in the game is Carl Icahn or it's me, right? Neither of us really have 10% of a large public company, and particularly if you put holding thresholds on it. Now, then there was one more round of compromise effort, which really went on last year at the commission, which was, let's do this a whole different way. Instead of, and I think this goes to these federalism issues, instead of the SEC mandating a procedure for being able to get access to a federally regulated proxy statement, instead of that, let's put this in the shareholder proposal process, and then, you know, whatever companies and shareholders decide on through that process, that's the system, and it's not mandatory, and it's just like majority voting or like the classified board. It's part of the process there. And then there were versions of that put additional limitations on that concept in that area.
And that approach arguably is more consistent with federalism because it really would be something that would then proceed under state law and the state could have whatever restrictions on it wanted.
And oddly enough, many investors felt it was actually better because it was more flexible. Right? And the so But no compromise has ever been reached yet, even though all those things were floated. John's characterization of your proposal, I think, is accurate in terms of the way investors would react to it. I think it wouldn't be viewed as really much of a compromise. Now, let me say a word about the subject that always comes up in these things, which is, you know, who's really legitimate here? All right? Union members, right, which are union members are about 12% of the population, and more the population. I mean, more the population. You count family members and so on and so forth. We participate in benefit funds with about $5 trillion in assets. Right, we have a real economic stake in these matters. Now, how is that money invested? Well, it's invested lots of ways, and not all of them are smart. And there's lots of different funds, and they do all kinds of different things. Right, and it's not the AFL-CIO's purpose or mission or power in any sense to control all their investment strategies. It can't be done. But most of the big ones, and in my opinion, most of the smart ones, right, recognize that they do not have an information advantage in the marketplace, and they invest generally with most of their assets, not all, in things that are essentially indexed or quasi-indexed. All right, so they hold corporate America broadly over a long period of time. Right. Now, they do other things, and it's not. And some of the things they do aren't always smart because they sometimes want higher yield and all this kind of stuff. But the bulk of the money is invested that way. That is a fundamentally different strategy than, for example, a governance hedge fund, right, which tends to be very focused on particular companies, often tends to be very short-term in terms of its strategy, and has an ability to move in and out of their positions, either literally or through derivatives, that is completely different than the way a pension fund behaves. Now, our funds in their core of their position, you may view them as illegitimate in some sense because you don't like the fund's governance structure, or you don't like the individuals who run it, or you object to the notion of collective savings, or whatever your various problems are. But we are real investors in these companies, and we have real long-term horizons. If you're going to think about who ought to be on the other end of some kind of accountability mechanism. Oh, and by the way, we are not that different in that respect from, say, the Vanguard S&P 500 index fund. Right? Now, the Vanguard fund is governed differently and run differently and all that kind of thing. But if you're going to think about who is it that ought to be on the other end of whatever accountability mechanism there is for corporate directors, right? We are not a bad choice, right, because of that. But maybe you believe that we're like bad actors and bad governance and all that. Well, how would you want to deal with? How would you want to make sure that we don't do it alone, right? That there's some check on us. The way you do it is by having requirements that essentially require that whatever we do, we'd have to do it in concert with other people with different governance structures, as you might put it, closer to the marketplace.
And you have to have a holding period.
Well, yeah, you have to have a holding period, in my opinion. I mean, you just have to.
Actually, that's a very nice commercial, I think, Damon, for your...
That's what I'm invited here for.
Right. And I largely subscribe to it. And I would just add as a footnote that the Damons and others representing the major employee pension funds and public pension funds came together with the Business Roundtable and other business groups and major corporations 2 years ago to develop the Aspen principles of getting away from short-term thinking with respect to the American economy. And I think it's perfectly true that these funds are the ultimate capitalists that are invested in the market. The problem, I think, is the suspicion by many in the business community that those who manage these funds, and it may or may not be justified, and I'm sure it varies from fund to fund, sometimes use that capital power to pursue social goals which are not in the best interests of the investors, namely organizing and the like. And there have been some incidents which at least are viewed by many, including those not necessarily in the business community, as evidence of that. I think, again, it's a very varied landscape. But I think that's the reason why you get that reaction from the business community. Yes, you're capitalist. Yes, you're invested. Yes, you're indexed. Yes, you're in for the long term. And in some cases, I think the cooperation has been superb. But there is always a suspicion that when it comes to an election contest or a shareholder proposal, that you ally yourselves with interests that are not interests tied to the welfare of the institution, but rather to a goal of the labor union movement.
Can I see if there are other questions out there? One back there.
Chief Justice Vesey, you commented, you touched on this a little earlier. about the role of fiduciary outs in bylaw proposals, and I was just wondering if the panel could comment on how the presence of a fiduciary out provision might affect the legality, if not the validity, if not the wisdom of shareholder bylaw proposals.
I think there's something in the CA case that implies that there might be a way to provide for a fiduciary out. For example, if you take the proposition that the bylaw would provide that the directors that a stockholder must be reimbursed unless there is a fiduciary reason that the directors in their judgment determine it's not in the best interest of the corporation, that might save it. That was implied, I think, in the CA language. So that might be the key to solving that part of the problem.
Lee, do you have a question? Sorry.
Can I just make one quick comment on that? I read CA as requiring fiduciary outs in order that 141, the relationship between 141 and 109 requires fiduciary outs in these bylaws. The more interesting question that I don't think CA answers clearly, because there's some conflicting language in the opinion, is whether a fiduciary out is sufficient. That is to say, could a bylaw that had a fiduciary out in it nevertheless be inconsistent with 141? And there's some language at the beginning of the opinion that suggests a negative answer to that question, but I think there's some language towards the end. There's some very strong director primacy language towards the end that suggests that 141 could trump.
True, but at the end of the day, what the court said in that case and what they say in a lot of other cases is that it's all highly contextual. You have to see exactly what is being proposed and exact language and how it comes out.
Chief Justice Steele thought it was important for the court to be unanimous there, and speaking with him, I'm sure Norm's spoken with him as well, the opinion written by Justice Jacobs is a compromise opinion, so there's something in it for everybody on the court, which means it's a little hard to take clear, bright-line rules from it. And I think
it's not the first one of those.
No.
Well, I think that will have to be our last word.
Do you want to give me 10 seconds on this?
Sure.
I think a lot of investors think there's a fiduciary out that can be crafted, one. Two, I think there's an interesting intellectual issue that we didn't really address, but I will just flag it, which is that, and it goes to the contextuality of this opinion. I think it's very important in the way this got crafted that we were talking about a payment outside, what was being contemplated was a payment to a party outside the corporation. And that at some point you bump into essentially, and someone mentioned it earlier, the Blasius issue, right? There have got to be bylaws that one can write, right?
Sure.
And what is the nature of what would the CA decision suggest the nature of those bylaws are? It is ones that are purely about the functioning of the corporation and don't necessarily. And I'm not saying this is the totality of them. But that you get into a different arena when you start paying money outside the corporation,
right.
and that the fiduciary duties attach very strongly there. I think there is this interesting intellectual tension between those sorts of propositions as asserted in the opinion and the conception of the kind of absoluteness of voting rights and process that exists in the Blasius line.
As always at a Federalist Society panel, expert and informative panelists on a timely topic with a variety of perspectives. Let's thank the panelists and thank you all for coming.